Our next speaker, Chilton Williamson Jr., just released a book on Mexico, Mexico's Way. He has worked as literary editor at the National Review from 1976 to 1989. He has been senior editor for books at Chronicles. And there he just started a new column called What's Wrong with the World? So now he's going to come to the podium and tell us perhaps what's wrong with Mexico and Latin America.
And what's Chilton, right with Mexico?
Chilton Williamson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chofwin. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I want to speak to you this morning about Mexico, a country that has fascinated me for at least the past 20 years. By its politics as well as by its people and its culture. I'm a desert rat. I do a lot of hiking, camping, horsebacking in desert country. And some of the most beautiful deserts in North America, as you probably know, are to be found in northern Mexico. The Chihuahuan and Sonoran deserts have always, in fact, spelled Mexico for me. I've never actually visited the south. I've explored some of this country, and as some of you may know, and as has just been mentioned, I've written a good deal about it over the years, including in my nonfiction book, The 100th Meridian, which came out several years ago, and now my new novel, Mexico Way, which is set in northern Sonora. I've even nibbled around the foothills of the northern extent of the Sierra Madre Occidental without actually daring to explore them for reasons that I'll come to at the end of my talk. We've been hearing about liberalization and authoritarianism in Latin America. In the case of Mexico, I read the country's history since independence as the story of an aspiration toward liberty from 1821, the year Mexico cut loose from Spain, down to the present. This aspiration has been known in Mexico as the revolution, by which is meant the vague history of a vague and realized agenda in search of which the country has lurched between anarchy and authoritarianism for nearly 200 years. At times, these two things, liberty and authoritarianism, have existed side by side in the same country, as was the case off and on during the Mexican Civil War, whose dates are usually given as 1910 to 20, though I usually think of the Civil War period as ending in 1928, with the assassination of President Obregón by a Cristero posing as an artist in a restaurant in Mexico City. Before 1821, the history of Mexico was perhaps less authoritarian. Certainly it was calmer, if only because it was more of a peace than it became after independence, just as I suppose you could say the history of the 13 North American colonies was quieter than that of the United States has been since 1789 for the same reason. Before independence, final authority rested with the distant Spanish crown, or whoever controlled the crown. For a while, you remember, it was a Bourbon, later Napoleon Bonaparte. Of course, there can be, and there were, rebellions against royal authority, as well as hostilities between the peninsulares, the creoles, the mestizos, and the indios. But only after Mexico became a discrete nation could she really formulate a distinctly Mexican political agenda. I mean, that is, a distinctly Mexican politics in search of a Mexican political system. The politics came naturally. It was a politics of impatience, of impulse, of passion, of lack of restraint. Mexican politics has always been full of human drama and color, which is what gives it fascination and appeal. Unfortunately, Giuseppe Verdi never wrote an opera with a Mexican setting. I wish he had. The closest he ever came was Don Carlo. A stable Mexican political system is always elites, and nearly all the elites struggled to ensure elite dominance over the masses, close quote. And there, I think, you have the history of Mexico between a capital letter and an end stop. Now, the year 1857 comes early in the period of the Reforma, which lasted from 1855 to 1876. In that year, a new constitution established a government that emphasized centralization over federalization in an apparent resolution of a dispute dating from colonial times. But neither the liberals nor the conservatives would recognize the more radical aspects of the Constitution. And so the conservatives were able to overthrow the new president, Ignacio Comonfort, and replace him with General Felix Zuloaga. The result was the brutal War of the Reform, which lasted from 1858 until 1861. The war was won by the liberals, but the conservatives refused to relinquish their ambition to establish a monarchy. Their efforts resulted in the introduction of Maximilian of Austria into Mexico and into Mexican politics, the emperor's brief reign, and his bloody deposition. Benito Juarez, a hero of the war against the French, served three terms as president. He was certainly a reformer, a man who did much to promote the nation's economic recovery and to establish a basis for political stability. But his successes had the effect of convincing Mexican liberals of the usefulness of a centralist government, long sought by their conservative opponents. Juarez's successor after his death in 1872, Miguel Lerdo de Tejada, who served as president of Mexico until 1876, continued his predecessor's economic development policies, which were largely aimed at enticing foreign capital to Mexico. However, like Juarez himself, Lerdo took a flexible view of constitutionally imposed term limits and was defeated by Porfirio Diaz, a hero of the French War, who had criticized him for seeking another term in office. In this way, a political move to defend the liberal aims of the Constitution of 1857 ended in the return of government by Caudillo, a government that lasted effectively from 1876 until 1910. So far, the great issues in Mexican politics had been land reform, the conditions of the peasants and the working classes, the status of the two great privileged corporations, that is, the Catholic Church and the army, and the centralization question. Under the Porfiriato, as down to this day, these issues remained, in some form or another, fundamental to Mexican political debate. But Diaz was interested in more than political power. He was eager for what David Brooks has called national greatness. Like Lerdo and Juarez, he continued to hold Mexico open to foreign investment. Also like them, his main concern was for the interests of the elites that owned and ran the country. Yet, as Mexico industrialized, the Mexican people began to experience industrialism's rigors and to protest against them through local, regional, and national workers' associations. Diaz's response to industrial strikes in 1907 was to send in the Federal Army, which fired upon the workers, killing women and children, including as well as men. It was these associations, allied with rebel elements of the Federal Army, that overthrew Diaz and sent him into exile in Spain in 1910. Now, for more than 50 years, the Constitution of 1857 had been the idealistic and sentimental touchstone of Mexican liberalism. But this form of liberalism in practice was not democratic. It was rather elitist and fundamentally authoritarian in that particular way, well known, I think, to all of us here, in which liberalism and authoritarianism can coexist. Moreover, the Treaty of 1911, signed after Diaz's departure, divided Mexico against itself. As Burton Kirkwood has written, a historian in Mexico, quote, "The revolution, that is, the Mexican Civil War, quote, was never a homogeneous phenomenon, but rather a series of multiple demands for fairly specific issues, from land reform to the status of the church to economic policy." Here is one reason, apart from the Caudillo principle, why the revolutionists divided themselves across a spectrum of Istras, that is, the Maderistas, the Carrancistas, the Zapatistas, the Villistas, Orozquistas, Obregonistas, Callistas, and so forth. To the extent that the leader of each of these groups was out for anything but himself, he was after something completely different from the others. Nor was any of these leaders, Madera excepted, operating within his own moral universe, his sphere of authority, as much else than he was as a brutal authoritarian. This is what makes the Civil War, to me at least, the most thrilling and the most perversely alluring chapter in all of Mexican history. That may seem like a callous statement, callous assessment of one of the most brutally destructive decades experienced by any country in modern history. On the other hand, the history of pre-modern Britain was also brutal and destructive, and somehow we remain thrilled and even exalted rather than appalled and depressed by, say, Shakespeare's rendering of this history. And surely no more Shakespearean character ever lived than Pancho Villa, a man who was capable equally of bursting into tears before pardoning the prisoner he had originally condemned to the firing squad, and on the other hand, ordering in a fit of murderous rage the shooting in cold blood of 100 women in a small village after the widow of one of his soldiers cursed him for what she considered to be his responsibility for the loss of her husband in battle. Beyond the removal of Porfirio Diaz, the Mexican Civil War or Revolution established little to balance what it destroyed. One of its few accomplishments was the Constitution of 1917, established by Venustiano Carranza's constitutionalists at Querétaro, which Mexican politicians were to invoke for the next several decades, much as their predecessors had invoked the Constitution of 1857. Another was the Plan de Agua Prieta, pronounced by Obregón in April 1920, by which he won the support of unions, the agrarian associations, and the military. This accomplishment, which seems harmless and even beneficial in itself, nevertheless institutionalized and fortified the central government's role as mediator and adjudicator between all the various interests represented in the Mexican political arena. This development, more than any other, is responsible for the fundamentally authoritarian nature and shape of Mexican politics, from Obregón's successor, Plutarco Elias Calles, down to the current president of Mexico, Felipe Calderón. This period of Mexican history, since the founding of the Partido Revolucionario Nacional by Calles in 1959, has sometimes been represented as having effected the consolidation of the revolution. Actually, the process was more like the consolidation of one-party rule in Mexico under the aegis of the revolution, as the PRN was replaced by the Partido de la Revolución, which in turn gave way to the Partido Revolucionario Institucional. Now, it's true that the Partido Acción Nacional, founded in the late 40s, has succeeded in the past decade in winning the presidency for two of its candidates, Vicente Fox and Felipe Calderón. Much has been made of these two elections, which are often said to have broken the one-party hold dating from 1929 on the Mexican government. But even as the official national party has swung between left and right during this period, the authoritarian tradition has been maintained by the government's continued role as the central broker of Mexico, in large part through its nationalization of certain industrial sectors, of the labor unions, and of the agrarian associations, and also by its ability to determine the relationships that exist between these interests. As Octavio Paz noted in 1975, quote, "The real remedy is not to be found in a reform from the top downward, but rather from the bottom upward, a reform strongly backed by an independent popular movement," close quote. Unfortunately, more than three decades later, reform continues to proceed in the opposite direction. Inevitably, the Mexican government's close relationship with the business class in particular has led to corruption and either unfair or illicit profit-taking from the financial and industrial sectors. This was bad enough when business meant oil or agriculture. But the situation became catastrophic during the presidency of Carlos Salinas de Gortari, when Mexican government, as far as the highest levels, bought into the drug trafficking industry and its aligned system of political murder. As you may recall, the president's brother, Raul, is currently serving a 50-year prison term for the murder of Ruiz Massieu, the Senate Majority Leader, who had worked for democratic reforms in the PRI. And both brothers have been implicated in the murders of Luis Donaldo Colosio, the reformist PRI candidate for president in 1994, and also in the killing of Cardinal Juan Jesus Posadas Ocampo near the Guadalajara airport. Now, I don't mean to criticize Calderón and his efforts since becoming president to confront the drug traffickers and their bought-off public officials when I suggest that in the long run, as maybe even in the short one, they're not going to work. Since Calderón took office, the drug trade has simply become stronger and more endemic than ever in Mexican society, while the related drug wars between the government and the narcotraficantes, as well as between the cartels themselves, have grown more widespread and more brutal. Calderón has mucho corazón, but it is still hard for me anyhow to see how he can save his country from ruination by the greatest disaster that has ever befallen it. It's hard to see at this point, I think, how anyone or anything could. Now, the reason for pessimism goes beyond the obvious corruption by the drug trade of Mexico's political institutions. What I fear is a corruption of the Mexican character of a Catholic people themselves that the drug culture is already producing. A According to an article in the New York Times on October 3rd, a survey by the Mexican government found that the number of drug addicts in Mexico has doubled in the past 6 years to 307,000, and that the number of those Mexicans who have experimented with drugs increased from 3.5 to 5.5 million people. Just as the militarization of Mexican domestic policy can only strengthen authoritarian tendencies within the central government, so the moral corruption of the Mexican citizenry can only abet those tendencies. I recommend to all of you a superb book published last month by Free Press. The author is Richard Grant, who is a British citizen living in Tucson, a very adventurous fellow. The title is God's Middle Finger. This is not meant to be a blasphemous joke. It actually refers to a 17th century religious statue made of wood and missing all the fingers on one hand except the middle one that Grant came across during a drunken fiesta in a Tarahumara village at the bottom of a canyon in the Barranca del Cobre system. Grant's a brilliant writer in the great tradition of British travel writing. He's also a man of real courage, one who has gone where I have never dared to go. Here we get back to the Sierra Madre. And I'm thankful, having read his book, that I never attempted to go in there. The Sierra Madre has some of the most gorgeous country in the world. It's also the bastion of drug growers and traficantes who produce and smuggle so much of Mexico's homegrown marijuana and cocaine. His book, as I say, is a great adventure story. It's also a terrible revelation of the social and spiritual destruction that the drug industry wreaks upon active participants and bystanders alike. The Mexico Grant describes is a Mexico from which Christian belief and morality both have been expunged, where the most wretched excess is not so much condoned as it is barely noticed, where personal immorality has become the norm, and men drunk literally on gallons of beer take pericazos, that is parakeet blasts or snorts of cocaine, and smoke mota while bedding prostitutes and stealing other men's wives. In Grant's Sonora and Sinaloa, particularly Sinaloa, the moral order has collapsed together with the social and political one, and in fact with the law itself. In this Mexico, anyone who decides your wife is prettier than his wife can give the police a false tip that will result in his arrest and indefinite incarceration, or more simply, his murder, which will go unpublished and probably even ignored. Tocqueville predicted in Democracy in America that Latin American societies could never support democracy. I believe that Mexico, at least, not only has failed ever to realize anything like liberal government, but that indeed it has actually passed what may well be recognized someday to have been its democratic apex. In closing, however, I'd like to say that I wish Mexico very well in proving Tocqueville and proving me wrong. Thank you so much.